Now, here's Dr. Stan Frager.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Always nice to have you with us. Very special night tonight. I know you'll find it very informative and very helpful. Been a lot of news about people having problem with drugs lately, both everything from movie stars to people who do crazy stuff. You have to wonder about, for example, in the welcome center on the highway where somebody was upset because some guy didn't turn his headlights off soon enough, and he shoots him a couple times. I'm willing to bet before it's all over there was drugs involved. Nobody just walks up and shoots somebody for no reason because they left the lights on in the welcome center. And the guy was explaining, he was talking to his wife, he was explaining to the fella who yelled at him about turning the lights off that it's automatic. They're left on for a little bit so you can get into the house. And so shot him twice. Good guy, and killed him. Oh, my goodness gracious. Let me tell you about some neat people joining our Sunday night family tonight. Candace Platter graduated from the Adler School of Professional Psychology, and she's the author of Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, and talks about the top 10 survival tips for loving someone with an addiction. And, you know, that really complicates something. If you love someone who is an alcoholic, who is a drug addict, you have some real issues. And it's going to be complicated. It is not simple. And a lot of times people get into the rescue mode. Well, I know he's an alcoholic, but I'm going to change him. I can't wait to hear what our guests have to say about that. As a therapist, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that, where they really, the client really felt that they would marry the person and they would straighten their life out and live happy ever after. Good golly. So we'll find out about that and more. So you'll find that Ms. Platter is very interesting. Way back in 1973, she found herself in the throes of a prescription drug addiction. And when we think of addiction, we think of people shooting up with heroin and things like that. But alcohol, of course, is one of the biggest addictions, as well as using pot on a daily basis, and had 15 years of abusing substances. And she kind of reached bottom in 1987 and has come back. She just celebrated 27 years of being clean and sober. Congratulations. What an amazing achievement, and you'll understand that achievement very shortly. Ms. Platter, how are you?
I'm really good, Dr. Frager. Hello.
Being good is an achievement in itself these days.
Yes.
Let me tell you who's with us in the house tonight as well. Good longtime friend Jay Davidson. And Mr. Davidson is the founder and chairman of The Healing Place. And it's an amazing place here in Louisville, Ms. Platter. And Mr. Davidson's been involved in developing the social model program of recovery for the past 22 years. The Healing Place is Kentucky's largest shelter recovery program for indigent alcoholics and addicts. And so it's a pretty amazing place. The oftentimes, I think daily, 250 men and women, is that correct, Ms. Davidson?
250 men, 250 women in Louisville, and then another 100 in Campbellsville, Kentucky.
Incredible. On a daily basis?
Daily basis.
What do you do in your spare time?
Advocate for recovery.
And proud to say that have been a longtime friend and admirer of Mr. Davidson, who has really built a program from nothing up to an amazing program serving thousands of people. I think we were talking beforehand. He was figuring out how many people over the 25 years that you've served, and it was
over 100,000.
Over, I mean, And you got to ask yourself, of those, how many of those people you literally saved their lives?
Yeah.
Because if you hadn't turned it, just like you, Ms. Platter, I mean, if you hadn't have turned that around, what would have your life been like? And mm-hmm. so how did you originally get into the field, Ms. Platter? Is it Dr. Platter?
No, it's Ms., but please call me Candace. I'm fine with that.
All right.
Well, as you were saying, in 73, I started using prescription drugs, and that's because I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease at that point, which is quite a debilitating bowel illness that has no known cure and can be very painful. So, you know, at that point, they didn't really know much about the illness, and they didn't really know how to help me, and so they gave me a lot of medications to kind of get me out of their office, I think. Some of them were things like Valium and Demerol, which would be like today's OxyContin, codeine, those kinds of drugs. And I was also using pot, which helped a lot. I mean, medical marijuana can be a good thing if we're careful. But, you know, anybody's body would get addicted to these substances, and they were all depressants. So if you fast forward about 15 years, I was very, very depressed and made a decision to go into recovery and to reach out for some help. And that was in 1987, and each day just made a decision that I wasn't going to use. And now, as you say, I have 27 years, which, you know, if anyone had told me that I was going to have 27 years clean and sober at that point, I would have thought they were crazy. And I know that if I could do it, pretty much anybody can do it. So what I decided was I was an educator, I was a teacher, and I was also a counselor, and I decided that I wanted to go into the addiction field and give back some of the things, some of the help that I had received. The more I found out about addiction, the more I learned about it, the more I knew that I wanted to be in that field helping other people. So that's what I did.
They talk about Crohn's being idiopathic, meaning we don't know the origins. I always liked that word idiopathic when I taught psychopathology. I used to tell them that it was a combination of two words, idiot and pathetic.
Yeah, that's kind of what you feel like.
It's like we don't know what caused it, we don't know where it's going, but here's a bunch of drugs that maybe you'll relieve the pain.
That's right, and they still know very little about Crohn's. They still know very little about how to treat it.
Crohn's and colitis are very...
We do things like take care of ourselves in many ways, including and especially diet. But, it's one of these things that if you have it, you have it. But it can be taken care of and helped and assisted.
Well, that music says we're going to go to break here in a second, but we'll be right back with Candace Platter and Jay Davidson. And we got lots of good information for you tonight. So keep it right here, and we'll be right back. I'm Dr. Stan Frager. Great to have you with us. All right. Hi, and welcome. Talking about loving an addict. What happens if you love someone who's an alcoholic or a drug addict? It presents a lot of issues. We'll find out about that and more coming up. And with us is Candace Platter and also Jay Davidson. Mr. Davidson, again, CEO of The Healing Place. Pretty amazing place, working with 200-300 a day. And what's amazing is successful with 75% of his clients are sober 1 year after program completion. That's an amazing success rate for that population. What do you attribute that to?
Three things, actually. We use a social model of peer accountability, where they're accountable to each other for 24/7. They also reach out and help each other to learn how to change. We use a 12-step basic model of change.
Now, that accountability, is that also like some peer pressure?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's no secrets at the Healing Place, including all of the staff. And so 3 days a week, the men or the women get together in a meeting and hold each other accountable for inappropriate behavior. and suggest strength-based positive ways to change that behavior. One alcoholic reaching and giving a hand up to another alcoholic who wants to change.
What's the most often given suggestion?
Most often is write 1,000 words on first things first.
Write 1,000
words on first things first. Or what's the spirit of the program? A lot of the suggestions are directed toward introspection, to really get serious about why you act the way you do, why it's not appropriate, and a lot of action steps too.
Give me some examples.
Going to extra meetings, having some extra opportunities to serve your brother, your sister by working in the kitchen. Working and serving snack time in the evenings, other opportunities to give back to your brothers and sisters.
In other words, it isn't just take, it's give.
Give, give, give. It's really all about give, because as I was an alcoholic, I was taking from everyone, everything, every time. But now I have an opportunity to give back.
Had you reached kind of the bottom?
I mean, absolutely.
Did you get into a situation where it was just pretty dismal?
Yep. Yes, I was. I've been using alcohol for about 23 years, and I got to the point where my boss told me I'd either need to get recovery or he was going to fire me. And I was a major on the promotion list to lieutenant colonel, and I didn't want to lose that. And I said, I'll get into treatment. And that was 31 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And they kept you in the Army.
They did. And they promoted me. And then I came out, and the rest is history.
You know, I've spent the last several years, there was a period back, very intensive, with the military on a military-wide basis on policy, turning around the suicide in the Army. Very serious problem. We had a nice reduction for the first time in 12 years last year. Sadly, it's on its way back up again, which is surprising since we've had a reduction in force, and that was unexpected. It's very frustrating. We have found out some of the things that work, mainly resiliency training at the very basic level, that first sergeant and the spouse at home. Mm-hmm. When it comes to like Fort Campbell and battle-ready soldiers, it's about 95% men. And so it's a situation in which they, they come home, terrible stories. No one should see it, much less some young man, 19, 20 years old. And it's a very serious problem. But one of the things we picked up on, and the reason I mention it, is the fact that one of the problems we have in the military is, for example, somebody's having trouble sleeping. And Ms. Plato, you can probably relate to this. They have trouble sleeping, so they tell their buddy, and their buddy says, well, the doc gave me this medicine, helps me sleep better. Why don't you try it? And they start sharing drugs.
Yep.
And that's a neat way to get started, using drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a real problem. Tell me, you've written a lot about this, Ms. Platter, what is the main message you want your readers to understand?
Well, you know, my book is a little bit different than other books on family addiction, because I'm really focusing on the loved one and not on the addict. A lot of times, loved ones feel a lot of guilt and shame about their loved one's addiction, and one of the basic messages, I have a few, but one of the basic ones is that the loved ones are not responsible for the addiction. They are not responsible for anybody else's choices. And the problem is that most of them have contributed to the situation, usually by enabling behaviors that are not going to help at all and will keep the addiction going.
But, you know, when you see a loved one in trouble, be it, say it's your son or daughter, and they're abusing the most common drug, I guess, is alcohol, And you don't want to just see them, whatever age they are, 15 to 25 or 30. How do you just let your child get to rock bottom without helping them? That you want to, now you call that enabling, we call that enabling. Or Jay, what would you say? What do we do here?
Well, that's the problem because, and I know Candace will agree with me that the disease of addiction or alcoholism, it is a disease that the earlier you intervene, the less intensive the treatment, the shorter the treatment period, and the higher the probability of a success. So for a long time, we've just looked at the elephant in the room and not confronted it, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so I'm a firm believer in...
So we have this elephant in the middle of the room because we're watching the person destroy themselves, say, as an alcoholic.
And we love them. And I just love Candace's approach of love the alcoholic and addict. Like, I agree with that 100%. But that's where we end up with that definition of tough love that says, at some point, you have to say no. At some point, you have to say the behavior is no longer acceptable, but I love you, and I will do everything I can to help you. But you've got to be willing to participate, and you've got to be willing to want to change.
Right.
That's a biggie.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a biggie because they've somehow gotten by up to that point.
Yes, and what happens is that the loved ones become basically addicted to the addict's addiction.
Yeah. Right.
So what I mean by that is that when an addict is doing well, the loved one is doing well. And when the addict isn't doing so well, then the loved one isn't doing so well. And what the loved ones need to do, the family, the friends, the colleagues, the brothers, the sisters, whoever, is to take a step back and come off that roller coaster, because we all know that chaos is the roller coaster that an addict in active addiction is always on. And the loved ones need to come off that and set some clear, appropriate, healthy, loving boundaries.
Yes.
And start taking care of themselves.
Talk about that.
Absolutely, because unfortunately the family, to deal with this chaos, develops inappropriate coping mechanisms just like the addict does in their addiction.
And exactly.
And in fact, they need, and my mantra is the family needs to get help even if the alcoholic or addict is not willing to get help.
Oh, I so agree with you. And, you know, if we've got somebody who's in a treatment program for addiction and they come back to a family or continue to have contact with a family that continues to be dysfunctional, the chance of relapse is much higher.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen it time and time again where the family has gotten so used to the addictive behavior that when this new person comes back after a lengthy time of change, they don't recognize this person anymore, and it makes them very nervous, and they were more comfortable with the addictive behavior than they are trying to learn.
Well, the addictive behavior was more predictive for them.
Right.
They were used
right.
to seeing the person constantly right. in turmoil, constantly having these issues.
Right.
Now the person comes back, and they've changed.
If I could just address what you've just
Please.
Said, Jay, about being comfortable, you know, we all use addiction to be comfortable in some way, to be more comfortable than we were feeling before.
Right.
And the loved ones are doing that as well. So many of them are codependent, which
sure.
the simple definition of that is that they put other people's needs ahead of their own on a pretty consistent basis. They're people pleasers.
Yeah.
They hate conflict.
Yeah. Yeah.
They'll say yes when they shouldn't.
Right.
And that keeps them comfortable. Conflict makes them very uncomfortable. So at the same time that an addict is learning how to change their dysfunctional ways, the loved ones need to do exactly the same thing, because it makes them really uncomfortable to start saying no, to start setting those boundaries. But it's not a loving act to not set a healthy boundary with an addict. It's not a loving act. It's actually meeting one's own needs of not having conflict.
Absolutely. And it's just like raising young children. You've got to set boundaries to help them define what's appropriate and inappropriate behavior.
That's right. And then the other thing after that is that the addict has a choice about whether they're going to abide by those boundaries. And if they, because we can't force somebody to do that. And if they're not going to, then there have to be some consequences that are, again, healthy, appropriate, loving, but that are real and that mean something to the addict.
That's the hardest thing that I've seen. And it's usually moms that are the most difficult to want to say, I can't tolerate your behavior any longer. It's really difficult to get to that point.
All right. Well, we'll come back to this. We're not done. And I want to hear about those 10 top survival tips you got there. So we have lots of information, good information, and we'll hear more about the healing place as well. So keep it right here. We'll be right back. I'm Dr. Stan Frager with Jay Davidson and Candace Platter. And we're all here for you at 970 WGTK. All right. Hi, and welcome back with you, Candace Platter. And we're about to go into the top 10 survival tips for loving someone with an addiction. And also with us is Jay Davidson. He's the founder and chairman of The Healing Place, wonderful treatment facility here in our greater Louisville area. So, Candace, start us off with some of those great survival tips.
Well, would you like me to read all 10, or I can easily do that if you'd like.
Go ahead and give us a couple.
Well, I think there are three that are actually the most important, so maybe I can just tell you those. I mean, I think all 10 are really important, but three stand out for me. So the first one that I think is the most important is that you can't change another person, so stop trying.
Okay, and actually, what do you think, Dr. Davidson?
That's absolutely true. Only the person can change themselves.
Right. And you can't control or fix somebody else. For every one of these tips, I have a quote in my book from somebody else. And this one is my favorite, so it's very short. Can I just read it?
Lay it on us. Go for it.
Okay. This is from wonderful science fiction writer Robert Heinlein, who wrote Stranger in a Strange Land and many other wonderful books. He said, "Never try to teach a pig to sing. It's a waste of your time, and it annoys the pig." So, you know, I'm not
saying
that addicts
are pigs. What's that one about the pig? You'll be dirty and the pig
is happy. But, you know, it's a waste of your time to try to control or fix or change somebody else. You need to be doing some of your own work and then see what kind of boundaries you want to set that would be good for the addict and go from there.
Absolutely.
And to get some help if you don't know how to do that.
Absolutely, Candace. And I think the mantra is make sure that you take care of yourself so you stay healthy.
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the other three tips that I like so much is know that self-care does not equal selfish. Because if you're a loved one, if you're listening, you know that you've been putting your own needs on the back burner and focusing pretty much primarily on the addicted person in your life who you love so dearly. You just don't know what else to do. But that's not helping. And for you to put your own life aside is not a good idea for you, and it's not good role modeling for anybody else. And it doesn't help.
Absolutely, Candace. I agree with you 100%. If you don't take care of yourself, you're not going to be able to help anyone else.
Yeah, it's like what they say on the plane when the oxygen masks come down. They always tell you that if that happens, you put your own mask on first, even if you're traveling with somebody who's, you know, with a child or somebody who's sick or something
yeah,
like
say,
that.
Exactly. But you know what I wondered about, Candace, is that they say now if you're traveling with a child, put your own mask on first, then on your children, on your child.
Right.
Now, what if you got two children with you? My thing is you very quickly have to decide which one you like best. What do you think?
Well, you might have to make that choice, but first put on your own. Because if you can't breathe, you can't help either one of those
kids. I understand.
Yeah.
But I think the point is well taken. You've got to also take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. Because people almost self-destruct trying to help other people sometimes.
Yes, that's right.
Right,
and it doesn't work in most cases. And most people who are loved ones, most people who are listening today, they know it's not working. They know that what they're doing isn't working. They just don't know what else to do, which is basically why I wrote this book, because there are other things you can be doing that actually work.
Exactly. And we also always try to tell the family that you didn't cause the addiction.
You didn't cause the addiction. You may have contributed by enabling, by not having boundaries, by, you know, putting your own needs last, that kind of thing. But you have not been responsible for the addiction. So some of the shame and guilt you've been feeling about that, if you can, you can start to let go of that.
Absolutely. And you did, and you can't control it, obviously, because the chaos reigns well out of control. So you don't control the alcoholic or addict.
That's correct, yes.
So what do you do? I understand. Mm-hmm. We're talking about what you don't do. And of course, you said one of the things you do is to take care of yourself. What do you do to help the addict?
Well, I think what you need to do is give the addict that you love the message, I love you so much. I love you so much that I can't watch you self-destruct in front of me anymore. If you really have to do that to yourself, you're going to have to do it somewhere else. I love you so much that I'm not willing to support you in active addiction.
Absolutely.
If you want some help being in active recovery, I'm here, but I'm not going to work harder than you're going to work anymore.
That's exactly right.
So that's the boundary, and it's coming from a place of love. It's not coming, you know, you don't say to the addict, you know, you're driving me crazy, it's horrible. You know, it's like, I just can't take it because I love you that much. And most loved ones do feel that way. They just don't know how to express it. They're so frustrated and feeling so helpless.
I agree 100%, Candace. And another thing that I found that's really helpful is a lot of peer support where the family can reach out to meet other family members mm-hmm. that are going through the same thing, where they can mutually help each other, encourage and exhort each other to keep faith and keep sending that message of, I love you, but you've got to change.
Yes, and, you know, unfortunately, there aren't too many of those places where loved ones can make those connections. We have Al-Anon, which is great. There are some treatment centers now that have family programs. Some of them last a week, and some of them are in residence, which are just fabulous.
Of course, we have a wonderful in Louisville called The Healing Place.
Mm. We do have families.
You have a program for families?
We do. I have a master's level social worker that's in charge of the family program, and we do family days. And the first family day, of course, we have 500 clients on campus on a daily basis in Louisville, and we had our first family weekend. We had over 700 family members show up.
Wow.
It was a little daunting.
Things were a little tight.
But that just shows the hunger and the desire.
The need.
And the need for information and support.
And if they're willing to come and get some help for themselves, that's probably a big part of why your program is so successful.
It is. I mean, they want to be involved, but they want to do it the right way, and they want to take care of themselves, but they also want to be able to establish realistic and honest boundaries that they can maintain.
It's one thing to have a
boundary and then you don't maintain it, or it's something that's totally unrealistic. So,
well, you might as well not set it if you're going to do that.
Exactly.
Because every time you cave,
that's right.
Every time you give in to an addict, they just wait for you to do that again when you set the next boundary.
Well, the issue gets to be, what's the difference between helping and enabling?
Yes.
Right?
That's right.
Yes.
In one case, you help because you set boundaries and say, I love you, but this is it.
That's right.
And it's hard to picture that as loving. It's mm-hmm. probably the most loving thing you can do, isn't it?
It is the most loving thing that you can do. It is the most loving thing. It doesn't feel like that. In fact, I tell my clients that, you know, my loved ones who come to see me, that it's kind of like I'm kind of asking them to take their head off, turn it upside down, and put it back on their neck.
we use that term, tough love. And this is really a definition of tough love, is that love that says you have to say no.
Yes, tough love is love, and it's probably the most honest kind of love there is. If it's appropriate, if the boundaries aren't, you know, too cruel, if the boundaries are healthy and maintainable.
Enabling is allowing the addict or alcoholic to live in your basement, and you pay all his bills or pay his car payment and do all of those things while they try to make it job work, and then they don't make their job work, and you just continue to support them and take care of them, and that just you're just putting one nail after another in their coffin.
Yes, that's exactly right. Now, I have clients who have actually driven their addicted loved ones to the dealer or to the liquor store, because at least they know where the addict is. He's sitting right in the car with them. It's just so hard. It's heartbreaking to watch this kind of behavior go on with the loved ones and with the addicts. But it can stop. It can change. And it really, really can get better.
Yeah. There is hope for change.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, I know that, we'll get to it in a minute, but some programs require the addict to make the appointment and show up. And I have questions about that. Sometimes a loved one can get them to treatment, and then they will continue on. But what about when you depend on the addict to make the appointment and show up, hold a front ball game? Listen, we'll deal with that and more when we get back. Keep it right here. I'm Dr. Stan.
970 WGTK.
Hi, and welcome with us, Jay Davidson, Candace Platter. Jay, tell me a little bit, why do people say an addict has to reach bottom before they get help? Is that accurate, first of all?
Well, we've come to the understanding that it really doesn't matter how the alcoholic or addict gets to treatment. Coerced treatment works. We have the police bringing our addict or alcoholic into our non-medical detox on a regular basis. We have family members bringing that person into the detox on a regular basis. We have the alcoholic addict just walking in. It really doesn't matter relative to the treatment how they get there. The fact is that they finally decide they may not be totally serious about the fact they're sick and tired of being sick and tired, but we know that once they get into the healing place environment, they're going to see several people that are just like they are, but they're happy and they're making changes, and they say, I want what they've got.
But then they say, you see people doing better, mm-hmm. and yet they turn around and then crash and burn. Then what do? You pick them up and
absolutely.
Do it again.
Absolutely. We don't care how many times they have to come back, because you never know when that sunlight of the Spirit is going to break through that denial, and they're finally going to grasp it and decide, This is how I'm going to change this time. So relapse is a phenomenon that occurs with the disease. It's not a requirement, but it does happen. And I think everyone learns from that relapse. And so we have a policy that says no barriers to entry into the program, and you come back as many times as you need to.
All right. And then I'm wondering, how do you know if someone you love is an addict or an alcoholic?
They're starting to use a chemical on a regular basis, and they're starting the first part of it is getting social consequences. And in the family system, it's usually when they start breaking family promises. That should be a red flag to the family that all of a sudden they're breaking promises.
Candace, what would you add to that?
Well, I think that, you know, all of us have certain distractions that we use in life, you know, but a distraction becomes an addictive behavior when it really starts to badly affect a person's life. So breaking promises is one of them. Not being able to hold a job, as Jay was saying, is one of them. Physical changes that are being made. There's all kinds of ways there are signs to look for. I talk about that in my book as well. There are signs to look for in terms of whether somebody's crossed over. And it usually has to do with frequency as well. Like with an addictive behavior, it's going to be happening more and more often. You can take somebody who uses cocaine, for example, any mind-altering substance, they're going to start maybe once on the weekend, you know, with their buddies, and then they're going to go twice on the weekends, and then they're going to start using during the week, and then they're going to be using pretty much every day. And so frequency is really important when looking at whether something is an addiction or whether somebody's a social user or, you know, what the difference is.
Especially when they start having consequences for their addictive behavior.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Cannabis. Yeah. And when the families aren't going along with the consequences, when the
right.
families are rescuing
right.
the addicts from their consequences, the addiction continues. I think that, you know, the best way to stop addiction is to stop the enabling.
Absolutely.
Right?
It's difficult for the family members who really love, they believe that they don't want to see their, quote, son or daughter out on the street or in the gutter.
I know.
They don't want
to
see
them
homeless.
That's so hard for them.
It is. And the fact is that if nothing changes, nothing changes. And if they don't really believe they have no reason to change, they're not going to.
Yeah. I love that saying. It's just the most wonderful little profound saying that if nothing changes, nothing changes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've had clients, and it gets so bad, they're stealing from their own parents, or they steal from loved ones. Unbelievable stuff. You wonder, what are they thinking?
Stan, the biggest frustration we have today is that the young people that are getting hooked on opiates are getting opiate pain medications out of their grandmother's medicine cabinets. And they're starting with that. And then they start to get tolerance levels increase, and they start needing more and more and more. And now here in Louisville, I don't know about you, Candace, but here in Louisville, we're experiencing a heroin epidemic.
Yep, here too.
Where are you located, Candace?
I'm in Vancouver, Canada.
Yeah. 18 to 25-year-olds addicted to heroin.
Yep. Heroin is bad, and so a lot of people are dying.
Yeah, and from what we see, the heroin today is 70 to 80% pure, where back in the 60s when I was around, it was like China brown and black, and it was like 20 to 30%. But today, it's really powerful, and that's why we're having overdoses.
Yes, that's right, because it doesn't take much to overdose.
No. And it's a lot cheaper. The OxyContin pill was here in Louisville was $1 a milligram for a 80-milligram tablet. So you were paying $80 for that single tablet.
Oh, my gosh.
You were paying $80 for that single tablet. And now today, tenth of a gram of heroin is about $25.
So it's so much easier to just use the heroin that's going to kill you.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, what a tragedy.
I heard the cocaine is a huge problem also.
It's fading. They're really... Well, here's another complication, and of course, methadone's been around for a long time as an antagonist for opiate addiction, and so now Suboxone's out on the market, prescribed by doctors, and unfortunately, Dr. Stan, we're now seeing Suboxone abused.
Right.
Oh my.
So, you know.
Yep. Methadone is abused too. At least here it is. Both of them are.
Yeah. And Candace, and I think you'd agree with me, we always try to legislate against a drug or a chemical, but that's not the issue. It's about the behavior. And so having a bill that talks about heroin or alcohol really doesn't get to the underlying issues of how do we change that behavior.
Right.
That's why we need more treatment as opposed to...
Exactly. And I totally agree with what you said before, Jay, that if we don't understand as addicts and as loved ones, too, if we don't understand why we're shooting ourselves in the foot,
right.
if we don't understand why we're using behaviors that aren't helpful and that are really hurting us, we're going to keep doing it. We have to understand that. So addiction is pretty much a symptom of what's underneath it.
Absolutely.
And we have to get to what's underneath it.
Yeah. And what I've learned is that alcoholics and addicts don't like to be in pain emotionally, psychologically, or physically. So they use the chemical to feel differently. If they knew what to change and how to change it, they'd have done it a long time ago. But they don't know what to change or how to change it.
I can't think of his name. He used to be in charge of all the drug addiction for Jefferson County Schools.
Frierson? Dr. Frierson?
No, can't think of his name right now. But he pointed out to me, he said, you know, Dr. Stan, he said, there's only one reason people do drugs. And I kind of that piqued my curiosity. He said, there's only one reason. He said, to feel better.
Yeah,
so right. That's why they do it, which ties in exactly, Jay, to what you were just saying in terms of whether it's physical, mental, or emotional, it's to feel better.
That's
remove the pain.
Exactly.
In fact, that's one of the problems we have with our soldiers is they've been through so much emotional pain. So you don't always see it physically. Right. And people wonder, is this PTSD real? Let me tell you, folks, it's very real.
Yeah. And the alcoholic and addict are also don't want to admit that they have this disease, because if they do admit it, then they have to do something about it. So the denial is so strong.
Mm-hmm. And it's the same with the families. They feel so much shame around what's going on. They don't talk to anybody about it. They don't, you know, until they meet other people who are going through the same thing, and that helps a lot. But most of them are in such isolation, not talking about what's going on for them.
Well, that's that stigma that we've put around addiction. And so I've come to believe that practically behind every door there's a story.
Yes.
And today, and if we can just get people to start talking about it and start sharing, they'll find out they're not alone. And that's the message. You're not alone. You can get through
this. You're not alone, and there is help out there. There are actual things that you can do differently that are going to help.
Right.
I think that when we're walking down the street, it's like 99% of the people on the street are affected by somebody's addiction, either their own or somebody else's. It's amazing. They're not talking about it, but everybody, it seems like these days, unfortunately, is affected by addiction. The problem is that the people who are affected, many of them don't know that so many other people are also affected.
That's exactly right.
And there's a question if they even care. They're so wrapped up in themselves and their own issues. Do they really care about others?
Hmm.
Well, I think that that's entirely possible, but I also think that you don't want to address your own situation unless that you know that there's a possibility for change.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Candace, I want to thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
And by the way, Tony Safina is our ACE Media researcher. If you go to Frager.com, click on Tips from Tony and Dr. Stan, you'll find all kinds of information, including the two books that Ms. Platter has written, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself. You'll learn the rest of those top 10 survival tips and all kinds of good information. And we always thank Tony Safina for the great work he does, plus all kinds of additional resources. So, and then also in there is Jay Davidson, how you can reach him and The Healing Place, and information about The Healing Place. So, Tony, thank you for doing that.
Yeah, thank you, Tony.
Okay.
Candace, thank you. I really enjoyed being on the air with you tonight. It's been a pleasure.
I was just going to say that, Jay. It was lovely to meet you.
Yeah, and you too.
Thank you so much, Candace.
The work you're doing.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, the time has passed quickly, and we're about to say adieu to one of our stars. You'll hear about him in a minute. But Alan Jenkins is the producer of our show. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Jeremy, who is on the board and keeps things running for us. And, of course, David Allen, assistant producer. And this is his last night, but I keep telling him he can't go. We're not going to let him go. And so he has to just stay. But somehow he's kicking, screaming, telling me that he's going back to the university anyway. Okay, David, we're going to miss you.
I'm going to miss being here.
All right. What have you learned the most while you've been here now? What are some good things you've learned?
I think the thing that you've stressed the most to me is that I need to talk a little bit faster.
Doesn't he have a great voice?
Yeah,
I mean, David has a great voice. It's like, whoa.
Thank you.
And it really has been good. I hope you've picked up some good things. And you've certainly been a tremendous help to us.
Definitely. It's been fun learning everybody. You know, you guys are great.
So thanks a million. Okay, well, we're going to talk about family court next Sunday night. You will find it very interesting, I promise you. So don't miss it. Judge Byers and Attorney Lewis Winter will be with us. It all happens next Sunday, and it's, of course, from 8 to 9. I'm Dr. Stan Frager. See you then.